How shall we spot and read a trend? Huxley's chessboard. We reveal ourselves in the metaphors we choose for depicting the cosmos in miniature. Shakespeare, unsurprisingly, saw the world as a stage and all the men and women merely players. Francis Bacon, in bitter old age, referred to external reality as a bubble. We can make the world really small for various purposes, ranging from religious awe before the even grander realm of God, but a small parenthesis in eternity, according to Sir Thomas Browne in the mid-17th century, to simple zest for life, as stated so memorably in a conversation between the paragons for such a position, Pistol and Falstaff, "The world's mine oyster, which I with sword will open." We should therefore not be surprised that Thomas Henry Huxley, the arch-rationalist and master of combat, should have chosen a chessboard for his image of natural reality. The chessboard is the world, the pieces are the phenomena of the universe, the rules of the game are what we call the laws of nature. The player on the other side is hidden from us. We know that his play is always fair, just, and patient. But also we know, to our cost, that he never overlooks a mistake or makes the smallest allowance for ignorance. This image of nature as a tough but fair adversary, beatable by the two great weapons of observation and logic, underlies Huxley's most famous pronouncement that science is simply common sense at its best, that is, rigidly accurate in observation and merciless to fallacy in logic. From his great popular work, The Crayfish, 1880. Huxley's metaphor fails, and our task in revealing nature becomes correspondingly harder because we cannot depict the enterprise of science as us against them. The adversary at the other side of the board is some complex combination of nature's genuine intractability and our hidebound social and mental habits. We are, in large part, playing against ourselves. Nature is objective, and nature is knowable, but we can only view her through a glass darkly. And the clouds upon our vision are of our own making. Social and cultural biases, psychological preferences, and mental limitations in universal modes of thought, not just individualized stupidity. The human contribution to this equation of difficulty becomes ever greater as the subject under investigation comes closer to the heart of our practical and philosophical concerns. We may be able to apply maximal objectivity to taxonomic decisions about species of Pogonarophons in the Atlantic Ocean, but we stumble in considering the taxonomy of fossil human species, or even worse, the racial classification of Homo sapiens. Thus, when we tackle the greatest of all evolutionary questions about human existence, how, when, and why did we emerge on the tree of life, and were we meant to arise or are we only lucky to be here, our prejudices often overwhelm our limited information. Some of these biased descriptions are so venerable, so reflexive, so much a part of our second nature, that we never stop to recognize their status as social decisions with radical alternatives, and we view them instead as given and obvious truths. My favorite example of unrecognized bias in depicting the history of life resides quite literally in the pictures we paint. The first adequate reconstructions of fossil vertebrates date only from Cuvier's time in the early 19th century. Thus, the iconographic tradition of drawing successive scenes to illustrate the pageant of life through time is not even two centuries old. We all know these series of paintings, from a first scene of trilobites in the Cambrian Sea through lots of dinosaurs in the middle to a last picture of Cro-Magnon ancestors busy decorating a cave in France. We have viewed these sequences on the walls of natural history museums and in coffee table books about the history of life. Now, what could be wrong or even strongly biased about such a series? Trilobites did dominate the first faunas of multicellular organisms. Humans did arise only yesterday, and dinosaurs did flourish in between.